This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It is working on some magnificent landscapes and having the chance every now and then to get out there and see some of the best of America. Those experiences make you feel very, very humble and insignificant at times as a human being with a short period on this planet. And it's I think that's good medicine for anybody to take.
From an environmental standpoint, Nevada is a state of stark contrasts. When we think of the Silver State, most of us picture the Las Vegas Strip, but Nevada is also home to picturesque canyons, rare desert wildlife, and majestic snow-peaked mountains. This week on Sea Change Radio, we hear from two participants from the 7th Annual Clean Energy Summit, which took place on September 4th in Las Vegas. First, we focus on Southern Nevada, as I discuss Las Vegas' energy needs with Rose McKinney-James, the chairperson of the Clean Energy Project. Then we turn to the northern part of the state and hear from David Bob Zien, a state assemblyman from Reno, who talks about the efforts of the Conservation Lands Foundation, as well as the recent announcement that Tesla will be building a major electric vehicle battery plant in his part of the state. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Rose McKinney-James. She's the chairperson of the Clean Energy Project. Rose, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much.
Tell our listeners first what the Clean Energy Project is, if you will.
Happy to. The Clean Energy Project, or we call it CEP, is a nonprofit, a nonpartisan organization that is focused on advancing a conversation around clean energy. So we are very interested in energy efficiency. We're very interested in the deployment of renewables and broadly in sustainability and environmental stewardship. We do some advocacy around issues that affect broadly clean energy, and we are responsible for supporting the Clean Energy Summit, the National Clean Energy Summit, and we've done that now for 7 years.
And that's where we are right now for our listeners. Can you give us an overview on what the Clean Energy Summit's goals are?
I think the goal is to coalesce the experts in the field to move the needle around a conversation that says clean energy makes sense. That there is economic value, there is environmental value, and also to put a spotlight on what's trending around clean energy. So years ago, we were focused on the portfolio standard. We continue to look at issues that affect climate and any of the issues that come from that conversation relative to investment long-term.
And if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about your background beyond the Clean Energy Project, it's pretty extensive.
I have a background in government service, and I've served on a number of capacities, including as a member of the Utility Commission in Nevada, and thereafter as the director of the Department of Business and Industry, which is like the Commerce Department for other states. I also served as the chief executive officer for CSTAR, which is the Corporation for Solar Technology and Renewable Resources, in an early effort to try to expedite the deployment of solar and other renewable resources. So I've been around the state for some years. Nevada has been my home for over 30 years. And most of that time, I've been working toward advancing the policy framework that supports clean energy.
When I was looking on the website describing the Clean Energy Summit, there was renewables, renewable energy, and clean energy. So it seems like clean energy includes natural gas. Is that fair enough to say?
I think that is a fair statement. Natural gas and a combined cycle recognizing that the availability of natural gas to work with renewables is something that a number of innovative companies are looking at. Solar, as an example, works quite well with natural gas. So we're looking at the production of energy in the most environmentally sustainable way. And so it does include gas, beyond kind of the traditional renewables, wind, solar, and geothermal.
And Nevada has quite a bit of all three.
We have a ton.
Why don't you explain from your stint at the Utilities Commission a little bit more on how the state's grid is looking towards the future?
Well, we have recently achieved a significant goal, and most people don't recognize it, but Nevada tends to be two states. We have North and South. And the southern part of the state includes Las Vegas, and the northern part includes Reno and some of the rural areas, Elko being a large city. And Nevada 1 was a transmission line that finally connected the grid so that we have a statewide resource. We've not had that in the past, interestingly. And so we had two sort of significant circles associated with energy development and distribution. And so now we have the opportunity to connect more favorably to the entire region and to do a more efficient job around how we move our energy around the state. As an example, the northern part of the state has a tremendous geothermal resource and the southern part has a tremendous solar. We have a difference in climate. The northern part of the state in Reno and Tahoe get lots of snow and tremendous wind on the ridges. And in the southern part of the state, we have a significant amount of solar. So we found a way to more efficiently manage those resources and with a thought that we can also do it in a more cost-effective way.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Rose McKinney-James. She's the chairperson of the Clean Energy Project. So, Rose, as an African-American woman, can you talk about some of the policies that are in place right now and ones that you would like to see developed further to help those in need, those who kind of don't have as strong a voice in these kind of big grid-type issues?
Well, it's a significant issue because we all want to keep the lights on, and some of us are in a better position to do so than others. And so there's a reality associated with any economic platform that a fixed income is going to be far more challenged when there are additional costs, particularly if you're looking long term. And when you think about clean energy and the cost, let's just take an example of solar. While the costs have come down dramatically, the ability to afford those systems and to take advantage of some of the incentives that are in place are still limited to a demographic that I would consider relatively affluent. There are a number of policies that have been put into place to try to level that playing field. And the arbiters of making sure that there's equity there in most states are their utility commissioners. You come to a conversation around how to develop rates to make sure that they are equitable. And if you think about the long-term impacts of transitioning to clean energy, if you focus on the health benefits, as an example. These are important policy decisions that are made over a long period of time. So in Nevada, we have something called an integrated resource planning. And while those conversations take place within the hearing room of the commission, we also have a consumer advocate. Many states have identified someone who's responsible for making sure that there is a seat at the table for precisely the segment of the community that you're talking about. I know you mentioned the fact that I of African American heritage. I work with the American Association of Blacks in Energy, and one of our primary missions is to make sure that those of us who are active in the industry are actively participating on behalf of those who are broadly a part of our communities. And so as policies are developed, we make a point of asking the critical questions about what those impacts are going to be for communities of color, for low to moderate income communities, and those conversations are ongoing, particularly around what the deployment of these technologies really mean. Now, I will say to you that there are economic opportunities in terms of job creation. There are economic opportunities in terms of advancing technologies. You know, we just had this huge announcement around Tesla moving their manufacturing facility to Nevada. So those kinds of advances mean that hopefully we'll be creating some momentum that will rise, that will help create some rise for a lot of boats. The transition, though, I think, will be a little bumpy. It's always going to be a little bumpy. Change can be challenging, and Nevada is a state with a tremendous resource, and I'm hoping that the benefits of this change will be available to everyone across the board.
So we were talking about some of the great resources that Nevada has in terms of wind and solar and geothermal, but one of the things it doesn't have is a lot of water.
Correct.
And Mayor Goodman from Las Vegas has been proactive in putting forth some pretty progressive water policies. Despite all these resources, you got to have water. So how does Nevada have palaces like here we are today at Mandalay Bay? How does it sustain itself without a nice, steady supply of water?
Well, water is, in the West, probably the most important resource. And we have a very transient community here. We have people who move from other places where grass makes sense and they don't quite understand the world of the desert. You mentioned that Mayor Goodman has been aggressive. The Southern Nevada Water Authority has been increasingly aggressive in helping residents to understand the importance of water conservation. So we've had, for I think almost a decade, a comprehensive program where we limit the use of our water, where we provide incentives to remove turf. And the legislature is very sensitive to it as well, moving to support those technologies and activities that either reduce the need for water or don't require as much water. Yesterday, we broke ground on a project with First Solar and NextEra Energy. One of the things that they promote is a solar technology that does not use water. So by putting an emphasis on the importance of water conservation as we advance economic development, hopefully we're going to be able to come up with some ideas about how to use in a more efficient way the resources that we have. And Nevada is well positioned for that because of some work that was done almost a decade ago.
They've also been pretty aggressive in using reclaimed water for golf courses.
Exactly. And just so you know, Mandalay, Bellagio, a number of the major strip properties are very actively involved in using reclaimed water. Beyond that, the strip sits on a number of aquifers and wells, and the efficient use of that water is an important aspect of the management of these properties, because obviously we want tourists to continue to come, and they won't come if we don't have adequate resources, water being a significant aspect.
Rose McKinney James, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Bright light city, gonna set my soul on fire. got a whole lot of money that's ready to burn. So get those stakes up higher. There's a thousand pretty women waiting out there. They're all living the devil may care. And I'm just a devil with love to spare. So viva Las Vegas. Viva Las Vegas.
SeaChange Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to SeaChange Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on SeaChange Radio by David Bobzien. He's the High Desert Program and Digital Director of the Conservation Lands Foundation, as well as a state assemblyman from Reno, Nevada. David, welcome to SeaChange Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
So what is the Conservation Lands Foundation? What is your organization's mission?
So our organization's mission is to protect, restore, and expand the national conservation lands. And what's important is that the national conservation lands are America's newest system of protected public lands. Many people think of the national parks, the national wildlife refuges, or even the national wilderness system. The national conservation lands are lands such as national conservation areas, national monuments, wilderness areas that are managed by the Bureau of Land Management. These are lands found throughout the country, predominantly in the West, and it's an incredibly diverse mix of landscapes and cultural sites, everywhere from Alaska to Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, all over the country, and it's a collection of lands that is very distinct from other protected public lands in the country.
And the High Desert Program in particular, are you tasked with mostly trying to preserve artifacts, keep people who shouldn't be in those areas off the areas, or is it more protecting those lands from organizations and development? Are you an advocacy group in that sense?
We are an advocacy organization, but as a foundation, one of the things we work on is an attribute of the National Conservation Lands that sets them apart from other lands. They are so, what's important to those lands are the public private partnerships that happen between local organizations, friends groups at the local level that step up to do stewardship and advocacy for their local lands and the National Conservation Lands. So different friends organizations, we support them as a foundation in their work so that they can take the lead to protect and to steward their lands. So in my life, in my workday, I work with such organizations in Nevada, Idaho, and Oregon that do that work. And so, yes, some of it is stewardship on the ground in terms of restoration projects, but other things are advocacy. And we do work in the policy arena, making sure that what happens on the National Conservation Lands is consistent with the values that they seek to protect.
And in terms of your day-to-day struggles with the outside world encroaching on these lands, what do you find your butting heads against mostly?
Well, I think a lot of it is finding the place for these lands in a rapidly changing West, and certainly pressures from urbanization, development of energy resources. There's a whole host of threats to the National Conservation Lands that we're concerned with and that we seek to address. Day-to-day, for example, there's a wonderful landscape in southern Nevada known as Gold Butte here in Clark County that is in desperate need of protection. It's a fantastic collection of sandstone formations, archaeological sites, petroglyphs that are really vulnerable to overuse and pressures from the outside world. So we are supporting organizations that are seeking protection through designation as a national conservation area, the Gold Butte landscape. And our hope is through the protection, we'll get more people introduced to the land to support it, but also protect it from those outside threats.
So a neighborhood or more community-based advocacy group that's focused just on Gold Butte, for example, mm-hmm. they would reach out to your organization, Conservation Lands Foundation, and then you would provide them with more umbrella services and try to get them, get their message out to a wider audience?
That's exactly right. And with Gold Butte, it's the Friends of Gold Butte. They're based in Mesquite. It is a small volunteer organization that leads hikes. They do planting projects, and they also do advocacy for their landscape. We feel it's very effective. It's the most effective to have those local voices that are located next to the landscape to be the primary advocates for that landscape, and Gold Butte is a perfect example of that model.
Nevada is very divided into north and south in terms of topography. It's a very different type of desert in Reno because you get more, you get snow and you have mountains and a different set of challenges, I imagine, from your organization's perspective. Can you speak to some of those?
Certainly, when you look at southern Nevada, you're talking about the Mojave region. It's a different climate. It's a different landscape in many respects, and certainly around Reno, it's the Great Basin, high desert, and you know, the landscape that I work with in northern Nevada is the Black Rock High Rock National Conservation Area, which is a very vast landscape with all kinds of stunning features and vistas and animals and, you know, plant communities, but that. A lot of the pressures are the same. I mean, you have concerns about what would happen with overuse. You have concerns about, you know, urban pressures, no matter where you go. But, you know, even between differences in the landscapes in Nevada, also part of the National Conservation Lands in California is the California Coastal National Monument. You couldn't get more different between that piece of the National Conservation Lands and, say, the Black Rock High Rock in Nevada. The King Range National Conservation Area in you know, northwestern California is another example of a landscape that's part of the National Conservation Lands.
Drink whiskey, second time I lose, drink gin, third time I lose, I drink anything, cause I think I'm gonna win. Ooh, Las Vegas, ain't no place for a purple like me, no. Ooh, Las Vegas, ain't no place for a purple like me.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to David Bob Zine. He's the High Desert Program and Digital Director for the Conservation Lands Foundation. He's also a state assemblyman from Reno, Nevada. So let's put your state assemblyman hat on for a minute, David. I don't know if it's an official announcement yet, but everybody here at this Clean Energy Summit that we were talking at in September 4th, 2014, is talking about this Tesla battery factory that just got unofficially announced, but it's happening, it sounds like, in your area of Reno. What does that mean for the region of Reno? It's one thing that kind of struck me is people think of Nevada as Las Vegas, but Reno is almost an extension of the Bay Area, and I think that's maybe why an organization like Tesla would be looking at Reno. Is this the future of Northern Nevada?
That is a key dynamic, is that, you know, Reno is you know, very much at the other end of the state from Las Vegas, and in a lot of ways we have a natural connection, I think, economically with the Bay Area and with that culture of innovation. And so I think those connections really put us in the running for, you know, welcoming Tesla to our region. Ultimately, though, I think the possibilities of you know, wide economic benefits extend to the whole state. There's no doubt about it. Certainly in the Reno area and across the state, people have been wondering about this this project for quite some time. There's been a lot of rumors about just how much work has gone on out at the site. And I think there's a lot of excitement about what it means for the future of the state economically, and not just in terms of dollars and jobs and housing prices and the rest, but also the kind of economic development and diversification that Nevada has desperately pursued for a long time. You know, we are no
beyond longer gambling.
Beyond the casinos and other warehouse logistics type of opportunities that we have, trying to find higher level of knowledge based jobs and industry in innovation, and that's certainly been a theme to the clean energy summits over the many years, is that we're trying to develop a clean energy economy that really is built on innovation. And I think Tesla is very much fits in that mold.
Keeping that state assemblyman hat on for a moment and maybe synthesizing it with your work at the Conservation Lands Foundation, David, what are some of the biggest challenges with trying to do what you do as a state assemblyman and also keeping fragile land from being overused or plundered by, for lack of a better word, by the oil and gas industry and mining as well?
For me, and what's important to me in all of my service, certainly conservation is a major part of it. From the state assembly perspective, from an economic perspective, from a perspective of what my constituents care about, the quality of life that we have in Northern Nevada is really unparalleled in a lot of respects because of the outdoor opportunities that we have for recreation on protected public lands. And, you know, people like to live in Reno because they can, you know, step outside after work and ride their mountain bike on the local, trail out their back door. And so, you know, that work and, you know, the constituents that I serve, so many of them are involved in conservation work and stewardship work, whether it's, you know, building trails or, you know, replanting landscapes or what have you. A lot of ways, my Conservation Lands Foundation work is an extension of that because I get to work with folks that are doing that same kind of work in other states and around the West. And so it's I'm very lucky to be able to do what I do.
What gets you excited about working for the Conservation Lands Foundation?
It is twofold. It is working on some magnificent landscapes and having the chance every now and then to get out there and see some of the best of America that America has to offer. Gold Butte is just a stunning landscape. So many people are familiar with, say, Red Rock Canyon, which is close to the Strip, you know, half an hour's drive from downtown Las Vegas. But there's so much more to Southern Nevada than that, and Gold Butte is a perfect example where you can just get lost in slot canyons and, you know, stunning panels of petroglyphs. You might have seen the photo that they had at the booth for Gold Butte. That was a photo that I took that is just a fantastic, one of the best examples of petroglyphs I've ever seen. And those experiences make you feel very, very humble and insignificant at times as a human being with a short period on this planet. And it's I think that's good medicine for anybody to take. The other thing I really enjoy about working for the foundation is working with other folks that have a similar respect and deep caring for these landscapes. You know, people that are doing it because they volunteer and it's the right thing to do because they care about their place. And that's incredibly rewarding.
David Bob Zien, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Isaac Hayes, Elvis Presley, and Graham Parsons. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.